This is OTB Sports Radio.
When Matt Busby signed me, I joined a club with three European footballs a year, a World Cup winner. Unbelievable to play with Busby. Matt Busby management was incredible. He picked players like a jigsaw puzzle. He didn't pressurise you. Go out and enjoy yourself. He never swore. Matt Busby never swore. Can you imagine that from a manager today? He never swore.
Off the Ball, Saturdays from 1 on OTB Sports Radio. Listen live on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power.
Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
And welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock. Joined this week by the former Republic of Ireland international David Myler, the football correspondent of the Irish Independent Dan McDonnell, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward to talk about the beautiful game, football and off the ball. Thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. We're streaming live as well, so you can watch us on the Off the Ball social channels for Periscope on Twitter, at Off the Ball on YouTube, on Facebook, and on the OTB Sports app for iOS and Android. Search OTB Sports in your app store now to download it if you haven't done so already. Just want to give my thoughts on what we've had this week, what we've seen, this crazy week about the Super League. The week most football people, I think, fans, players, managers woke up. An attempted coup, like something out of a third world regime, by vulture owners to set up a closed league and then threaten the ethos of the game, which is based romantically on the principle that anyone can win, a sport that should be based on competition, social community, belonging, also a global religion. And with the world mostly constructed under the rules of liberal market economics, football at the elite club level has just become another tool of the rich. But these owners, as they showed contempt for their managers and their players, failed to realise the world has changed. We've been living in a pandemic which has cost lives, severely restricted our freedoms, so it's taught us what's important. And for many football fans, as the world turns left or populist politically, the feeling that you need to have a voice, that you do have a voice. And after all, if you watch the Premier League or the Champions League or travel to games from Ireland, you buy the tickets, you pay for the subscriptions. The closed shop Super League was about one thing only. It was about money. For Real Madrid and Barcelona, about solving their massive debt burden. For Manchester United and Liverpool, though they're American owners, about increasing revenues NFL style. But what the backlash does is offer governments and bodies like UEFA the opportunity to properly regulate the running of clubs, delivering fan models of ownership, make solidarity payments more equitable, stopping the Wild West situation that we have now with the Champions League semi-finals, where oil states can buy success. You can see that by the makeup of Chelsea with Abramovich from Russia. You have then UAE influence on Manchester City, Qatar and PSG, and then you've Real Madrid, who's always been a football club supported at an industrial level in terms of debt. They're the semi-finalists of the Champions League. Football has not become pure and equitable since this revolt against the Super League. If it was, maybe Celtic would win the Champions League next year. But maybe in the 72-hour madness and this crisis, this downfall propelled by Occupy Wall Street response, almost as it is against neoliberalism, as Simon Cooper put on this show during the week, there is an opportunity, possibly, maybe I'm being too idealistic about it, for positive change. Johnny Ward, hope you're well. What did you make of all this madness during the week? What's your takeaway from what you saw?
Yeah, good afternoon, JD. It's been remarkable, really. You know, I suppose it's been pointed out that Jose Mourinho's departure seems like months ago now, considering the week that we've had. Initially, from the perspective of somebody who's kind of, you know, immersed in the Irish game and, you know, goes to matches where there are only a few thousand at games and, you know, supports a league that is basically one of the lower tier leagues in Europe, I was kind of looking on with a little sense of what is this and why are they doing this and have they any sort of, you know, grasp of reality. And there was probably an element of almost like satisfaction when you support League of Ireland and when you go to games week to week to see that, you know, the game has been exposed maybe in terms of the owners at the top level for what it is. It was all about greed. It was all about the debts that you mentioned. It was all about American owners that are maybe a little bit detached, particularly with in the sense of the Glazers of Manchester United, trying to bring in more revenue. What was very encouraging for me, you know, Dion Fanning did an interesting article in The Currency today where he spoke about the age profile of fans going to games in England, that it's basically not affordable to bring your kids to a football game anymore. And what I was encouraged by, JD, was the reaction of working class fans, effectively, who probably feel disenfranchised with the game in England. I mean, even if you go to a Liverpool game now, and I've gone to a few Liverpool games in the past few years, you'll find that an awful lot of the people there aren't from Liverpool. There are a lot of day trippers, and a lot of people kind of, I think, working class fans have been priced out of the game in many respects in England. And what we saw this week was a revolt from those working class fans to maybe try to bring back the game to the people, to the people, because the game was of the people, for the people. And they found a voice. They were able to get through kind of, I suppose, rivalries between the likes of Manchester United and Liverpool and come together. And as much as I want to go to a Galway United game, I don't see myself as any different to the guys that want to go to see Manchester United play and have been doing that for years. But I've seen the game, you know, just enter a place in England and across Europe where probably the clubs and the owners recognise that the fans actually going to the game are far less important than ever. It's now about TV revenue. Maybe the top clubs feel that they're not actually getting a fair share of the money that's being put around. And obviously, globally, the people want to watch the big clubs on TV. But I was just really encouraged that fans have found a voice and basically were able to kind of bring an abrupt change to something that would have been absolutely horrific. It was completely undemocratic. A lot of these clubs with spiraling debts as well. And I think the lack of kind of player welfare for this as well. There are far too many games as it is. Gundogan, the Manchester City playmaker, referenced this as well, that players are a breaking point in terms of what they've been asked to do. And I was just as much as I come from a perspective of looking at this in Ireland, and Irish football isn't a relevance really in the overall scheme of things in Europe, I was just encouraged that our football fans, as part of the football family in England and in Europe, came out against this and found their voice. Because I do feel that since the behemoth of the Premier League started, that the game has moved away from its working class base in England, and I don't think that's been a good thing.
Liverpool have drawn 1-1 with Newcastle in the Premier League. We'll get to talking about that and get Jurgen Klopp's reaction. Let's hear from Jurgen Klopp now after Liverpool's 1-1 draw with Newcastle in the Premier League. What happened was Liverpool took the lead through Mo Salah. Callum Wilson then put the ball into the back of the net late on for Newcastle. It was ruled out for a VAR in the build-up, a handball. Very harsh on Callum Wilson. That's the rule. Joe Willock again scored late on, 95th minute. He scored a crucial goal against Spurs, another one against West Ham last week, and then he scored again against Liverpool today. So Liverpool failing to go into the top four of the Premier League. A 1-1 draw. Let's get the reaction of the German manager of Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp.
I don't think you can create much more chances, better chances than we did today. And we don't finish the game off. Obviously, he scored a wonderful goal. First one, didn't finish the game off and didn't play enough. Not even, it's not complicated. So obviously with a few passes we came always through. We just had to do that again and again. That they have then from time to time, that's how it is in football, a counter-attack, that can happen. But anyway, we have just to keep going, playing, and then keep the ball and let them run and these kind of things. And we kept them alive, obviously, and then in the end they, of course, deserved the goal. That's because they scored before, 2 minutes before, whatever. Another one, which is with the new rules, I saw it now once. Unlucky for Wilson, but it's handball. How we now use the rules, and then we don't even take this present. Didn't happen a lot that VAR was in our... We were lucky with that this season, but today we were, and then we give another chance away, and it's just, that makes no sense. And it's then really, really tough to take.
But watching on the touchline, it felt that you could see it coming, that because you have a lot of experienced players on the pitch, but they weren't managing the game to the finish.
Yeah, true.
And that must be very stressful. Why does that happen?
Yeah, because we have to, look, we have to... Why it happened, I don't know. How it looked, I saw. So it's just, you just have to keep the ball. We don't... in a specific way, we don't fight enough. It's not when the ball, when we make a mistake, we fight and try to get it back and stuff like this, but keep us ourselves like in a position where we dominate the game, which was possible today. For we had 70% of the ball and we should have 80. We should have 80% of the ball. So just, and then there's still moments when Newcastle, they are not bothered about that, when they have a counter-attack and these moments. Yeah, then if a goalie and you have to defend it, that's all fine, if you get something in that. But anyway, so it's like we create a lot of chances, didn't score with them, and we have to create more. That's how it is, and use them. So because it's like this in our situation, when you don't score with the way we score with the first pretty much, but then not with the second, not with the third, it always has this kind of impact where you see that, oh my God, it drops here a little bit, there a little bit, instead of going and just, who cares? A missed chance is just information, nothing else. But we don't do that well in the moment, I have to say. That's why I say it. In the end, it's deserved. You look at the stats and you think, how can that happen? But it happened, we saw it, and they fought for it, and they got it, and we got nothing, pretty much. Got a point, but you're right, it feels like a defeat.
And it makes it so much more difficult to get in that top four decision.
Yeah, but that's, look, I really, what we always said, if you deserve it, you deserve it. I didn't see us, that we deserve today, playing Champions League next year. We have another 5 games, we'll see what we can do until then. We have a few days until we play Man United, so it will be a tough one as well. But we learn, or we don't play Champions League. That's it.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Jurgen Klopp speaking to BT there. Apologies, listeners, for some technical problems that we had at the start of the show. We're good to go now. I reassure you with David Myler, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward here on OTB Football Saturday. Let's just get to Liverpool now, David. Was it a fair result, 1-1 draw?
Yeah, look, even you can hear from Jurgen, if you create that many chances, you've got to take them. The number of times Salah and Mane found themselves in positions to score goals, even Jota had several chances, they just didn't take them. And look, if you don't take them, you know that Newcastle are going to get one or two good chances. It's whether, you know, a case of whether or not they're going to take them. The thing that impressed me most about Newcastle was they stayed in the game. And even when Callum Wilson's goal was disallowed, you kind of, they might have felt that was their moment to get something out of the game. Then look, they stuck at it, and then Joe Willock gets the goal, and it all was deserved. It's obviously very disappointing for anyone involved with Liverpool because, you know, they dominated the possession. They just didn't see it through. I think Jurgen's touching on their game management of controlling it better. You know, they looked a bit frantic. They looked a bit all over the place in the last 5 to 10 minutes, where that's where you need someone just to put your foot in the ball and kind of control it and see that out, because look, the second goal just wasn't coming for Liverpool.
Joe Willock is a player exuding confidence. You see with Jesse Lingard at West Ham and Joe Willock again doing it today, David.
Yeah, no, definitely. Look, that's what, 3 in the last 3, you know, big goals and big games. The West Ham one, Tottenham. Obviously, you know, they touched on after the game. I think it was Des Kelly was interviewing him, said, you seem to be, you know, Steve Bruce's super sub. I know you'll want to start, but look, it's worked for him. Obviously, he brings a lot of energy when he comes on. He likes to get forward. He gets himself in good positions. That's why he's gotten the goals. So obviously, Steve Bruce will keep using him that way because he won't want to change, because it might be different if he starts him, you know, from the off. So, no, he's done really well and he scored some vital goals. That point looks like it's the one that's going to keep Newcastle, you know, in the Premier League.
If they can kill the Super League, David, they can kill VAR. Callum Wilson probably would have felt, what's happening here to me? And then, luckily for him, Willock scored.
No, it's ridiculous. Look, I get the handball, but what's between them? Like a yard, half a yard, like ball pops back up, it hits his arm. Of course, look, he gets the benefit of the bounce and he's in on goal, but it's just ridiculous. Obviously, I saw Peter Walton was talking after. He's talking about the rules are changing, but I don't know if you heard it, JT, but he said that if that was to happen again next season and Callum Wilson was to put in the back of the net, it would still be disallowed. But if it popped up, hit Callum Wilson's hand and another Newcastle player, you know, put the ball in the back of the net, it wouldn't be disallowed. So there's still a lot of confusion over these handball rules and what they're actually trying to implement. So it'll be certainly interesting to see how, you know, how it goes or how it works going forward.
I'm wondering, Dan, will Liverpool get top four?
Well, it doesn't look great. I mean, I know West Ham are playing Chelsea tonight, so obviously, you know, someone's going to drop points there, or they'll both drop points, or whatever way it works out. But, I mean, in theory, like, they're still close enough that, you know, if they win all of their last 5 games, you'd still think they probably would, but they've got some, you know, it's more about whether you would trust them to actually do that, you know. And I just thought it was shocking today, really, that you have like you have the let off of that Wilson goal being disallowed, which you can imagine like there's probably a punch in the stomach, because you can even see the initial reaction when Wilson scores, you know, God, Liverpool have let it go. Like, it was a bit of a mad game. Like, I mean, it could have been sort of, you know, 4-4 in the first half or something. Like, it was a wide open game. And like, there was various chances Liverpool probably could have killed it off. And I think Klopp obviously mentioned or referenced that in the interview. So when they get away with one with the Wilson thing, you're sort of thinking, well, yeah, they've got away with one and they'll just see this out. And the fact that they managed to just concede again, it sort of does raise, like, it invites all questions about sort of mental weakness and stuff like that, you know, which is not the type of stuff that players want to hear. You know, they can sort of, you know, they can probably accept certain things, but like this one strikes right to the heart of a team that, like, they're just a little bit mentally weak at the end. You know, you just expect them to close out that situation. Like, if you're a good, you know, tuned in side, you see out that and you get away with one and you shut up shop and that's it. And like, maybe they just got caught in the moment a bit as well too. But I just think, like, you look at the, you know, during the week, another late concession. It's just hard to see the confidence there to go on the run that they would need to do to get into it. And I have to admit, like, I couldn't see any scenario where they missed out the top four. We would have spoken about it even a while back when they were maybe rocking. I said, nah, listen, they're too good on their best day, you know, not to come into it. But I mean, there's just so many missed points, missed opportunities, bad games stacking up now. It's not a little blip now. It's more of a season-long thing, and they probably don't deserve it, really. I mean, from the Super League point of view, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people shedding tears for their owners and the fact that they've missed out, which I feel a bit sorry for, like, you know, Klopp and the players, who I think have actually acquitted themselves and handled themselves very well this week. But I don't know. I think as much as I would point out that, like, there's no real... I don't know where the good guys are in the Premier League ownership model as such, but you would be, yeah, you know, maybe there's a bit of karma with aspects of it. I don't know.
Yeah, 5-3-1-0-6. The powers that be at Liverpool chose not to buy a top class centre half in January when we so badly needed one. It was a gamble. It has not paid off, says Patrick. And Pat is in touch to say people say that Liverpool strikers missing chances had nothing to do with the defensive injuries. I disagree. I think the confidence has been knocked out of this entire team this season after Virgil van Dijk was injured. David, what do you think?
Oh, yeah, we can't keep using, you know, obviously Virgil, Joe Gomez, Joel Matip all been missing. Like, I saw some stat there. Like, Liverpool have had 146 shots since January at Anfield. They've scored 4 goals. Like, that's not good enough. That's regardless of, you know, what defenders are missing or what players. Like, yes, Salah has still produced. I think that was his 29th goal of the season. But Mane's, you know, run of form in front of goal hasn't been good enough. Firmino's not. Look, it's always been a massive question mark. Yes, I'm a big admirer of what he does elsewhere. That's usually when Salah and Mane are, you know, scoring goals. I think that's a cop-out, really. I think they do need to, you know, address the situation themselves. They need to score more goals. They're good enough players. We've seen it year in, year out for the last 2 or 3 seasons with the amount of goals they've been scoring. So I wouldn't have that, no.
5-3-1-0-6. I think we'd all be naive to think the supposed ESL isn't going away. It may lay dormant for the next 5 years, but it'll come back on a more palatable plate for clubs and their fans. This week wasn't a big win for football. It was just a signal that for the time being, the majority are just happy with the status quo, says Aaron in Galway. So Dave Myler, what's your takeaway now after everything that you've seen and heard and observed? And I'm sure you've spoken to your friends still involved in the game this week.
A lot of them, and this probably shows the naivety of footballers. A lot of them didn't really know what was kind of going on. A lot of them were more worried about what was coming up at the weekend, who they were playing, what position they were in, what was going on. You know, you kind of tend to have that tunnel vision where you're just focusing on your own team, like Liverpool making the Champions League, other teams trying to push into the top six, you know, other teams trying to stay in the division, whatever it may be. A lot of players didn't know. Of course, you hear the rumours of all these arguments between, like, the prime example is Harry Maguire, you know, going into Ed Woodward's to kind of say what's going on, and Jordan Henderson calling all the captains to kind of say we're not having this. My initial reaction was it was just pure greed. I was on Monday morning, obviously, with Jordan Owen talking about it. But it is fascinating, like, that the Premier League is no better in the sense of, you know, the big companies with your Sky Sports, your BT, they're driving the money. You look at now, like, the money that is paid to players is just going up and up. The transfer fees are going up and up and up. And we probably do need an independent regulatory to, you know, look over everything to make sure, because a lot of these clubs are going bust, and they can't afford, like, the main thing about the Super League was kind of like Barcelona and a billion debt, Real Madrid and 900 million debt, whether that's for, you know, stadium work or whatever. But there's been huge transfers over time as well. So that's a, you know, accumulation of a lot of things. But I just feel that it was wrong. You can't have this, you know, Super League thing with the 12 founding members. It just loses the competitive nature of football. You know, the big story that's probably been highlighted the most was Leicester City being in League One, getting promoted, and getting, going on into the Premier League, staying in the division, then the following season going on to win the Premier League. That's what dreams are made of. You know, I had those moments where I was promoted with Hull into the Premier League. You get to go to your Anfields, your Old Traffords. Can you imagine if there was a Super League where, you know, the teams aren't really playing? Like, when we were playing against those teams, they were fighting for something. They were fighting to finish in the top four, fighting to win the Premier League, whatever it may be. So I'm just happy that, you know, the owners have kind of come to their senses and kind of, you know, listened to the fans that who've made so much uproar. I suppose a lot of credit needs to go to kind of, you know, Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville for being kind of the driving force on television to kind of call it all out.
The players and the managers weren't treated very respectfully, though, were they, by the owners, David? It's pretty contemptible, I thought.
Yeah, but at the same time, JD, an owner's not going to, you know, an owner's not going to talk to a player. Yeah, okay, the manager should have been informed, but the players, like, they're not going to be informed. It's like this new, you know, Champions League format. Like, obviously, Johnny mentioned Gundogan kicking off on Twitter about it. You're not going to be, you know, asked about it. You're just going to be more or less told what to do. You know, if you want to play for one of these big clubs and you want to earn the money that you're earning, you're going to have to play these games. And look, there is an argument for, are they playing too many games? Yeah, they probably are, because if you're lucky enough to be at a Manchester City who go to the back end of the Champions League or whatever, and then you know, obviously we've got the Euros in the summer, he's a German international, he's going to probably go to the back end of that, you know, tournament with Germany, and then following season, then you're back into like a World Cup or whatever. So it's ongoing games, and there isn't much, you know, thought goes into, you know, players and how many games they're playing. But at the same time, can you imagine, even for you guys here, you know, your bosses at work, they're not going to console you on every situation or every decision they're going to make. It's kind of like you're told, if you want to be at this club, this is what's going to happen. I don't really see too much in that, but it is amazing, though, that there a lot of the relationships between managers and owners will be really tested. Because even when Jürgen spoke, I don't know, was it before or after the Leeds game, he spoke about, like, you know, John Henry was a good man, and, you know, he had a lot of time for him. They have a very good relationship. Even again today, he's kind of, you know, talking to fans about calming down the protests or whatever. But like, Manchester United fans have wanted Glazers out for what, the best part of 10, 12 years. That's not going to slow down. And then you can imagine Ali is kind of caught in no man's land, because he's an icon of the club. You know, all the fans love him. He's doing well. But then, is he going to go against his bosses inevitably? You know, there's a lot that's going to happen over the next couple of months with this.
Is there a chance, though, this could be a Daniel landmark, where we saw the protests outside Arsenal last night, that the UK government are making lots of populist noise, is that there could be a move from governments or from UEFA, well, I suppose with the Champions League format probably doesn't give much hope, that there could be a move towards making the game a bit more equitable and competitive?
Like, yeah, I mean, you'd like to think so, John. But I mean, you read out a text there from, like, you know, a Liverpool fan complaining, you know, they should have signed a centre half, and, you know, this summer, like, if, you know, global fans of a lot of these clubs will just be screaming, you know, they need to spend this, and why aren't they spending money on that, and you need to throw money at this and that, and, like, you know, those big clubs have the spending power to do it because of the global presence and power they have, which leads them to think about this, you know, the Super League idea, you know, the tours they can go on, the overseas revenue they can generate. And, like, so in a way, you know, people want to, like, even fans protesting, like, they want things to be a little bit more equitable or a little bit fair, but, you know, not too much, you know, not exactly. Let's not lose our minds here, because and that's, like, that would be the perspective of a lot of supporters when this settles and dies down, and then they just want their club to, like, be the best again. And I mean, yes, it has exposed to many people what a lot of people have known for a long time is that, like, you know, football clubs are hemorrhaging money in a lot of cases, even the most successful ones, but they can afford to do it. The system doesn't really stop them from doing it. Within the European football sort of system, there's still a fair bit of envy towards the Premier League because they're still in a better shape than the clubs that, you know, David referenced the situation with, say, the top clubs in Spain. And, like, there's like, it's a very, very imperfect system. Like, football, like, even the system that people were trying to protect this week, like, that one in itself isn't very fair. Like, I've made this point on the show earlier this week. I mean, like, the Champions League having four places for teams from loads of big leagues technically isn't fair. But the reason that that's the case is because it makes it a better competition that generates more money, you know, that more people want to watch it. And that money goes around Europe to fund football in various ways. Like, it's not fair, really, like, you know, as a champions competition. But that's the tweaks you make to be commercially successful. So you say there, John, like, what could happen now? Like, it is interesting, I suppose, the government interest. But I'm a little bit sceptical as to the extent to which it lasts for. Like, maybe when the sort of the big club owners are on the ropes at the moment, you know, wasn't there talk this week of, you know, the Premier League rules be rewritten to prevent them from launching a breakaway like this again, and that you get some kind of legislation in place? Because when even they were talking about punishments this week, it was a bit wishy-washy in parts, and you kind of wondered, really, was anyone ever really going to enforce it? Like, you know, UEFA weren't really going to punish, like, they were never going to kick the three clubs out of the Champions League because they need the money from this year's Champions League going ahead, you know, so... There's, you know, you would like to think that maybe it prompts some kind of, you know, evaluation of where we need to go with things, but I'm not so sure. Like, if you can get a certain commitment that, like, this, you know, that there won't be any sort of breakaway attempts within a period of time, but then it kicks the can down the road and it gives you an opportunity to regroup a bit. But, like, I don't know if the market is going to change that dramatically. Like, clubs are owned, like. Like, you'll have a club in England, like, for example, in Newcastle, you know, a club that's been struggling for a long period of time. You know, when there was a Saudi ownership situation maybe coming in there, like, there was a small bit of an ethical debate around it. But a lot of fans and clubs ultimately, well, we want that money because, you know, they want their club to get up to that level. Like, Chelsea and Man City have bought their way into the top table. Like, they bought their way into the top six with, like, you know, a Russian oligarch and, like, a Gulf state. You know, and, like, there's not a huge amount of romance in that we're preserving either. And financial fair play and other safeguards haven't really worked. If anything, they've sort of pulled up the drawbridge and made it harder to close the gap. So I'd hope that this would lead to a debate, John, but I don't know. I just feel in a month's time, in 5-6 weeks' time, like, we'll be talking about who needs to buy who, you know, who needs to spend money this summer. And a lot of fan anger this week, you know, will be generated, you know, will be aimed at clubs who aren't doing this or that. But I don't know. I mean, post-pandemic world, maybe there'll be less global travel. You know, there'll be less, you know, the day tripping maybe mightn't be as easy in the short term. Like, and I saw John Barron speaking this week about, you know, fans and ticket prices. And as much as these clubs are global operations that, you know, are watched, the great thing about football is watched around the world. That those clubs became a force initially because of their history, because of their fan base, because of the people who go every week all the time. And you'd like to think, you know, with ticket prices and stuff, that there'll be a way of reconnecting and apologising to some of these people. But I wouldn't be holding my breath.
Yeah, Johnny, I was looking at Nasser El Khelaifi from Paris Saint-Germain as the new chairman of the European Clubs Association. Bayern have won the last 8 Bundesliga, Juventus have won Serie A the last 9 seasons. All but one La Liga has gone to Barca Real since 2005. You take the miracle of Leicester out of it, only 4 clubs since 2005 have won the Premier League, the 2 Manchester clubs, Liverpool and Chelsea. Not likely that Everton or Celtic or Ajax or Benfica are going to win anything big unless they get a billionaire owner. And that's the crux of the issue here. It's still the Wild West, even though this issue has been thrown out, the Super League issue.
Yeah, obviously the German model has been mooted a lot in that, you know, you can't own, it's a 50% plus one model has been mooted, and German football has emerged very well in this. Aidan Fitzmaurice spoke a bit about this today in the Indo. Just German football, the way it looks after its fans, it doesn't overcharge them. There's actually good atmosphere at games. You can have a beer. It's a good place to watch football. But I do wonder, Dan mentioned the pandemic. You know, I even wonder about capitalism. terms of the way that people spend money, the way that we live our lives. And I think this kind of happened at a bad time, and that it was utter greed. It was out and out greed. And these fans that have been disenfranchised, I think as much as we can say this is going to be a massive change out of this, this definitely will galvanize fans, because they will kind of say to each other online, and they'll say to each other on WhatsApp, and they'll say to each other in whatever means possible, we did make a difference here. We basically forced this about face that happened over 2 days. And if fans can unite, I think we'd be in a far better place. And even watching Football Focus today, FC United of Manchester was featured, and obviously that came about as a product of the Glazers coming in. And football's in a dangerous place, JD. If you have these, you know, billionaire owners who are kind of, you know, running clubs to make money, or running clubs as a personal plaything, and don't really care about the fans. I mean, where are we going here? That's why I do love supporting the League of Ireland, because I go along to support people that I can relate to, and it's not really about money. And David Myler spoke about this as well, and I'd be interested to hear his views on it. Like the wage structure at the elite level now in football is absolutely bonkers. And the money that players are making, and the wage kind of demand.
Okay, Johnny, we just have a little bit of an issue with your line there. David, just want to pick up on Johnny's point there about the wage inflation of the game, and the maybe the disconnect between, I wouldn't say the players, because I think a lot of the players still have a deep connection like yourself with the people who pay their wages, ultimately the fans. But just in general, what are you speaking about there?
No, definitely. The prime example would be if you went back, say, 10, 12 years ago, if you played in the Championship for the majority of your career, you could, of course, I'm not saying for a second you don't earn a good living. You'd earn a good living, but it wouldn't exactly be money to set you up for life. But now, certainly, there's lads on 30 or 40,000 a week in the Championship who will probably never experience the Premier League. So if you look at it like on that basis, like the money is growing, and it's, it goes back to what Dan said about, you know, these teams in the Premier League who are throwing money at it to try and get to the top six. It's the same in the Championship. Teams are throwing loads and loads of money at it to try and get themselves into the Premier League, to try and get to the promised land. Certainly the wages, I don't know how they would do it. I don't have the answers, but it is, look, it's astronomical. You've seen this stuff about like Erling Haaland before like the Super League thing was announced, like his father and his agent going around Europe kind of touting him to different clubs. And you know, there's all these rumors that the father wants 20 million, the agent wants 20 million, and you're looking at like his contract plus the fee. Like, where does it end? You know, it's only going to continue to go unless somebody comes in and says enough is enough. This is kind of, I don't know how you do it, but kind of find a basis of what is enough.
I think like, I know we're probably coming towards ad soon enough, but like it's very interesting that David mentions the Championship there, because I don't know if you've seen it in recent seasons. The losses that clubs are running up in the Championship are incredible. Like even clubs like Leeds and Wolves who are getting promoted, the seasons in which they got promoted, like their losses were sort of astronomical at like a 60 million, 80 million mark. It's sort of like, it's sort of terrifying really. And yet you look at the Championship this season, and Norwich and Watford, who were relegated last season, you know, are going straight back up. And Bournemouth, who went down, are actually in with a chance in the playoffs. So, because you have the parachute payments, and then the clubs that come down and are back, like, so the whole system is sort of badly flawed in many respects. But I don't know, David. Like, the other thing is, like, if the game is generating that amount of money, I don't have that much of a problem with players getting it, as opposed to, it's more the agents and the, yeah, you know, and even the owners. And okay, so can you divert some money in towards, you know, better schemes or, you know, community stuff or whatever? But ultimately, like, if the game is generating that amount, you think, okay, you know, the players should still be beneficiaries to a degree. But I don't know, like, I mean, there was a salary cap in the lower leagues this year, and there was quite a bit of resistance towards it, you know, so. Like, how do you broach that with players, you know? Like, the idea of a salary cap, like, is what you would have to do realistically to cap it in some shape or form. But that's probably, people would say that's anti-competition in some way as well.
Yeah, and that is, look, you telling me if I, like, I know I'm retired now, but if I was a player and somebody kind of came in and said, you're getting, there's a salary cap. Yeah, you're going. Yeah. And I completely get that and I agree. But, like, you look at the example I heard, I was reading about one of the last few days was like Alexis Sanchez going to United for $500,000 like a week, and then he's not even playing. It's kind of like, that's just ridiculous, because you could get five players on $100,000 a week, which, you know, and it's kind of, that's what I mean, when it kind of gets that astronomical money, which is like far off, that you'd be thinking like, hold on, like, because you don't want to see clubs, like, that's where this came from. As you said, like, people, like, even for JD, who's a Tottenham fan, for years, people were saying, like, give the money to Pochettino to spend. But they obviously had plans to build a stadium, and they were kind of a bit reserved. But, like, it's just Daniel Levy is looking, okay, if we're going to, you know, give the money to a new manager, where are we getting the money from? And then, like, obviously, this was that 23-year agreement, like, $300 million a year. He's thinking, boom, there's my $100 million for players. You know, so I do get why they were trying to do it. I think it was completely wrong, but like going back to the wages, I don't know, Dan, the answer to it, but like you can't, there has to be kind of a way that clubs can't, you know, keep like running up massive amounts of debt, because then, you know, ticket prices are going up, the jerseys, the scarves, everything is going up. And it's just like, even Johnny said there a while ago, like, you know, going to games ends up costing, you know, families fortunes and that, and it's wrong. You know, it is football is meant to be about the people. It's, you know, the game that is played all over the world. It's watched all over the world. You know, any family should nearly be able to go to a game. Of course, look, getting tickets for a game at Old Trafford and Anfield is very difficult. Don't get me wrong, but there should be the occasion that, you know, you can go and it's not going to break the bank. And that's the problem. When these wages are going so high, the transfer fees are going so high, they're looking to recuperate as much money as they can. And eventually, it's, you know, it's the ones it hits are the fans.
Yeah.
Just on that, JD, the relationship between the club and the people from that city is in a place now where you're wondering, does it matter anymore? If you go to these big teams play and you see all these day trippers at the game, local fans can't really afford it. The players are brought in a globalized game from all over the world. Mightn't be even an English player on an English team, for example. There mightn't be anyone from the locality. And the lad who kind of maybe went along to Highbury as a kid and he wants to bring his two sons to the game now, what's his relationship with Arsenal? And does it really matter that Arsenal are a London team anymore? Does it matter that Liverpool are watched by a load of people who are not from Liverpool and owned by American owners who basically want to look to the global market of TV and, you know, a Super League? That does it really matter anymore, you know, where the team is from? And that's my concern, because I want to go along to watch a team in Galway with people from Galway playing on it, owned by Galway people and so forth. But if I'm a Liverpool fan and I go to a Liverpool game now and I can't really afford to bring my kids, whatever about going to away games, do I feel disenfranchised? Is this the game that I supported as a kid? I'm not so sure it is.
Okay.
Johnny, you were a bit supportive of the Saudi takeover at Galway. That was
brought, to be fair. I'll explain that in part two.
Good luck.
53106. This is Off the Ball Saturday with Dan McDonald, Johnny Ward, and David Myler. We're back after this.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
And you're welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you 3 to 5 o'clock. Speaking about the beautiful game of football in the company of Dan McDonald from the Irish Independent, the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward, and the former Irish international David Myler. Our coverage thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Just some texts on Liverpool. On 53106, Klopp's interview now just speaks volumes. He's totally stressed in search of solutions. Without the cool leadership of Van Dijk, Henderson or Milner, Liverpool play like headless chickens. Badly need an experienced winner like Toni Kroos to calm everything down. But the policy of not buying over 30s makes that unlikely, says Paul. And on the Super League debacle, 53106, people complaining about football going to an NFL model. At least the NFL have the draft system, which is a lot more fair than what's going on in the Premier League. It's like everyone has been living in the cave for the last 15 years, now complaining that money and greed are going to ruin football, says one of our texters. The Champions League is already sort of a Super League. The rich teams control things. Look at Man City. They could win it this year when they shouldn't even be in it. UEFA bottled it when it came to kicking them out for blatant breach of FFP, says Michael. That's his view. The players and managers are the media and public facing individuals for every club. Not consulting them was the height of stupidity and ignorance, says Benny in Galway. And ah, lads, we're not in the 90s anymore. It's a global game with global super players. The crack of local supporters going to Anfield and Old Trafford is over. The genie's out of the bottle. Fans want Haaland and Mbappe, not Johnny Local from down the road. It's the same with every major sport. Not saying it's right, but there's no going back now, says Brian in Kildare. Johnny Ward, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think Brian's probably right. Just to pick up the point that Dan made there, which is a very fair point to make, I did vote for the Saudi investment in Galway United because Galway United effectively don't own anything. They don't have any real assets. So we were told that the Saudis, who obviously made all their money from oil and so forth, were going to come in, throw a load of money at Galway United. And if my attitude was, well, if the worst thing happens and they leave the place like in a mess, we can't have any less than we have now. So that's why I voted for it. But as time passed on, I was delighted that Coleman Brothers got involved instead. And we're now kind of a fan-owned club. But yeah, at the time, I did vote for the Saudis, which is something I probably grew to regret.
I don't know if there's going to be a T-shirt. I voted for the Saudis out of it, Johnny. But it was interesting that Ed Woodward fell on his sword this week, Dan, wasn't it? He was one of the casualties of this.
Well, yeah. I mean, there seems to be various sort of levels of spin around why Ed Woodward went and was he going anyway, or was he opposed to it, or was he for it, or where he stood. And, you know, I'm not sure like where the truth fully lies on that. I wouldn't claim to have a clue, but I suppose, I mean, yeah, it was an interesting development, all right. And like I suppose the extent to which, like, I mean, there was a sort of a satisfying element to it that, you know, some of these officials, you know, probably thought that the game belonged to them. And listen, Brian is right with his text. Of course he is. Like, you know, in the sense that I think, like, you can't get too romantic for a time that is gone and that it won't come back. But I suppose you still have to, like, try and retain some aspect of personality of it. I mean, the Liverpool owners try and trademark Liverpool at one stage, you know? Like it's sort of what you're... It's sort of like, okay, everyone probably is playing the game a bit and, you know, sometimes, like, you ham up the romantic angles of clubs winning leagues, even Liverpool, when it's still you know, funded by this place and by this ownership. But you want to try and keep some element of connection or something there without going out of, without losing it completely. And clearly the Super League proposal people just lost it completely, in the sense that the power went to their heads and they thought that the game belonged to them completely. So whether that's the reason that Woodward is 100% gone, I don't know. But it's certainly one part of the fallout. I mean, Agnelli at Juventus as well, who's a pretty hard character to warm to. He seems to, you know, his status seems to have been diminished a bit. I mean, Perez, in terms of, he still seems to get very good coverage in Spain, whereas maybe he's been mocked outside it. But I'm not sure if it's how damaging it is to him. But there is something satisfying in that. But then, as you say, John, it's a slight tangent, but, you know, Agnelli, so this European Clubs Association is technically supposed to lobby for clubs all over Europe. There's a couple of hundred members, there's a couple of Irish clubs in it. And, like, you know, I've spoken to people about, you know, at meetings, they break into smaller groups. And really, like, the top end of it, like, the top clubs run the show. So, you know, when Agnelli leaves that and a couple of the other people, you think, okay, this could be a chance for the European Clubs Association to become like actually a force that lobbies for clubs. Because, I mean, the worst thing about Super League for me was it wasn't just like, there's obviously one angle of what it might have done to the Premier League and all, but it was actually that it was basically saying to clubs like Ajax, but even, you know, I don't know, Celtic or Red Star Belgrade or many big clubs around the continent who are like hotbeds of football in themselves, that there was no room for them at all at the inn, which I just thought was dreadful. But anyway, the European Clubs Association, Agnelli goes, you think, oh, I wonder what could be interesting. And it's like the Qatari head of PSG who comes in to take over. And you're thinking, well, this isn't necessarily, I'm not sure if the dude from Qatar who runs PSG is going to necessarily, like, you know, oversee a new era of, all of a sudden, let's have a form of socialism in terms of how we dole out our and Champions League stuff. I'm not so sure that's going to be the case. Okay. And maybe it's idealistic to expect that too.
Okay, we got to take a break for the news. David Myler, Dan McDonald, Johnny Ward back very shortly. Just give you some scores. Liverpool 1, Newcastle 1 earlier in the Premier League. Full-time in the Championship, Bournemouth 0. Brentford 1 half-times in the Championship. Barnsley 1, Rotherham 0. Blackburn 2, Huddersfield 1. Cardiff 1, Wickham 1. Coventry 0, Preston 0. Derby County 1, Birmingham City 0. It is Middlesbrough 1, Sheffield Wednesday 1. Nottingham Forest 0, Stoke 1. QPR 0, Norwich 1. And Watford 1, Millwall 0. All half-times in the English Championship. Earlier on at the rugby, the Women's Six Nations in association with Guinness, Ireland beating Italy by 25 points to 5, finishing third in the table. Well done to them. A win at Energia Park at Donnybrook. Back after the news. Don't go away for OTB Football Saturday.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
And welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock. Joined by the former Republic of Ireland international David Myler, football correspondent of the Irish Independent Dan McDonald, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward to talk about the beautiful game. 53106 for your texts. Plenty coming in on the Super League collapse and Liverpool's draw with Newcastle today, 1-1 at finished at Anfield. Our coverage thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. We're streaming the conversation as well. You can listen to us on News Talk, but you can also watch us on the Off the Ball social channels for Periscope and Twitter at Off the Ball, on YouTube, Facebook, and on the new OTB Sports app for iOS and Android. Search OTB Sports in your app store now to download it if you haven't already. David Myler, what's the vibe over there in England at the moment? A lot of heat outside Arsenal last night against Kroenke. Is this just going to die down? Is this going to be forgotten about this week in time, do you think? Or will it actually signal bigger changes in the game and the way the game is consumed and the way the game is related between the clubs and their fans?
I think after the collapse of the Super League, I think the fans obviously made their voices well known. I don't think this is going to slow down, JD. There's a big talk of a big protest for United Liverpool, which is next week. I think that's a massive one that I think, you know, Liverpool fans and United fans are getting together to obviously protest against the owners. I don't think it's going to, you know, die down anytime soon. I think it will be ongoing, certainly to the end of the season. Whether or not it will make much of a change, you can obviously, like, United fans obviously want the Glazers out. Arsenal fans want Kroenke out. Liverpool fans at the moment want Henry out. Whether or not they'll sell up, I don't know. It's not as straightforward as, you know, them just leaving. These clubs are worth billions of pounds. It's not, you know, you need someone to kind of come in and take them out of it. So it will be interesting to see how it goes on, but it definitely isn't calming down. There are a lot of angry fans who feel, you know, that it's gone on for too long and, you know, they're not happy.
Would you like to see a change in ownership at Liverpool, David?
No. Look, obviously John Henry came out and he gave his message. You can take what you want from it. I think they're, like, he has been very good for Liverpool Football Club. Yes, there's been mistakes made, even with tickets, prices, etc. Yes, there has been mistakes made, yeah. But he has a great relationship with Jurgen Klopp. You know, they've won the Champions League and the Premier League the last few seasons. Don't think it's a toxic, as the other clubs. So I'd like him to stay in charge. I know a lot of fans, Liverpool fans, are angry, but you know, there has been great success over the last few years. If that started to diminish, or if Jurgen suddenly became unhappy with, you know, stuff off the field, and he then decided to leave, or kind of vented his frustration towards the owners, it wouldn't be great. Certainly at the moment, I think that their relationship is strong, and I think I would like to see him stay.
Woodward is gone, David, as we were speaking about with Dan there just before 4 o'clock. Joel Glazer is the guy there. Whether they... I don't know what the Glazers... like. Who knows what they think? Whether they're going to maybe get out of this now or not, or whether they're going to try to continue to take their dividends and run the club the way they've been running the club. But I think they need to get their next decision correct, obviously, with who's running the club. Would Van der Sar be a good maybe move for them to try and prize him away from Ajax, or just get somebody? Like, they've got Solskjaer, who's very popular, obviously, as a club legend, and I think the jury's probably still out on the results side of that with the second place that's probably going to happen now in the Premier League, and they've got a chance to win the Europa League. But where should United be looking to go now? Or can anything really change until the Glazers are gone?
I don't think a lot can change. Van der Sar would be a great appointment. You know, he's obviously been around United for a long time. They love him there. He was very successful. But then you've got to ask the question, they might want him, but does Van der Sar want to leave his role at Ajax, a kind of family club that he's been involved with? You know, obviously played his youth football there before moving on to Juventus. Is he going to want to come and try and be the guy to kind of help Manchester United with his current ownership? I don't think so. The Glazers, what they'll do, look, it's been, like I said there earlier, 10, 12 years that United fans have wanted, you know, them out, and they've not left. So I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. I think they're quite happy, like you said, there to take their dividends and just stay there. They'll just stay in the distance and just leave it be as it is.
Is Jose finished in management at the top level, David?
Well, I think he's finished in the Premier League. You know, he's done Chelsea, United and Spurs. Man City aren't going to sign him. Liverpool aren't. You know, it's kind of, okay, Arsenal, I don't really think he fits there. I think the best thing for Jose now is to probably go to international management or maybe try head back to Italy and do something there. Look, I suppose he could go back to Porto and kind of do something with them. But I definitely think in England he's done. I think it's very unfair to say he's finished as a top manager. You know, it's kind of that emotional effect we've seen, you know, how successful and, you know, what he's brought to the game over the last 15 to 20 years. You wouldn't want to see him bow out now after the Spurs job. Where he goes is a massive question. I think he just needs to take some time for himself and then kind of look at what's next.
50 million in payoffs, the Athletic were reporting. 17 months he got Spurs, lads. In a normal week, this would be big news, but it wasn't a normal week.
No, it wasn't a normal week. And I suppose, I don't know, like it's not massively surprising it's probably ended this way for him, really. Like, that has the recent pattern. As to, you know, there's not much more you can say about that, really. I mean, obviously, the timing is still a bit unusual, but the cup final tomorrow, but, I mean, the signs had been there. So, obviously, everything feels like it's happening in a parallel universe now because, like, you haven't had, say, the fan anger in the stadium and a lot of the normal stuff that precedes someone going. It's all virtual in a certain way. I don't know, like, where you're, like, obviously, he's got the money from payoffs. Like, Jose, to me, is someone that it was inevitable he was going to go into probably international management at some stage. Or I'm trying to think, it was actually during the World Cup. I'm thinking I was over at the World Cup in Russia, and he was on Russia Today all the time as some kind of ambassador or something. Like, you wouldn't be a shock if he did a stint in, you know, a club in that neck of the woods or something, you know, like a really sort of highly paid gig with a Zenit or someone like that, you know, some sort of European club with ambitions, with lots of money. It wouldn't be a shock if he ended up there, or, you know, managed Qatar in the World Cup or something. You know, like, I mean, he's got such a star power that, and in fairness, like, you know, I don't know if he's the type that just wants to stay out of work and just be out of the game for a long period of time. I'm not sure if that, like, I'm sure he still has the, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but obviously, like, he has the ego that he wants the involvement. And, you know, for all that, a lot of these, you know, these super managers as such, they have a lot of their money made. Like, they don't need the money. Like, that's not a driving force for coming back to work. They miss the involvement. They miss being involved in the, you know, involved in the game and out there doing something. So he'll get loads of money, big money offers from places, you know, and I'm sure even, I don't know, the MLS model is slightly different, but, you know, he'll get really tempting offers, and I'm sure he'll pop up somewhere. But if he was, as David says, it's hard to see him come back to the Premier League unless the type of one that he would come in would be if there was, like, a big takeover of a club, you know, again, for, like, massive money, you know, a Saudi-style takeover, Newcastle-type thing. And you wouldn't be surprised to see Jose linked with being a manager for some kind of project like that. Because you can't see an established power hiring now in that way.
Yeah, Johnny, you and I like a bet, and Daniel Levy's been making bets, and they haven't been paying off recently.
No, and you know, 15 million payoff is quite something. It kind of goes into our argument about just the money at that level of the sport. But I didn't really feel that Mourinho was going to work for Spurs, to be honest, JD. You know, and speaking to you here every Saturday, I'd say about 80% of the time when you spoke about Spurs, your expression was glum, which was a reflection of the fact that they weren't even playing particularly good football when they even were winning. And I wonder with Mourinho, you know, he had an aura about him and he had this kind of mystique where he used to be able to get the best out of teams. And I think he had a power over his players, which even preceded the fact that he's maybe tactically been a little bit left behind in recent years. I do wonder, is that aura just gone now? Where players, you know, there was definite dressing room unrest at Spurs where they thought that he wasn't really training them properly in offensive situations, by all accounts. A lot of emphasis on not making mistakes and not giving goals away. I just think his aura is gone now. And I think he probably should more be remembered after his career for the brilliance of the early days. And like the, you know, we spoke about the improbable victories of clubs in a European level. You know, what he did at clubs that wouldn't have been, you know, entitled to do what they did at all. Obviously, the Porto days was really amazing. And I think he should be remembered for what he achieved earlier in his career, where he was a real upstart. He was an amazing manager. He knew how to get his players to play for him. And I don't know where Spurs go from here. It'll be a very attractive job because, you know, that stadium, living in London, where the club have been, it'll be a very, very attractive job, whether or not they're in the Super League or not.
David, has the generation of players changed in terms of their attitudes, that Jose could be a bit abrasive 15 years ago and they needed to treat them a little bit differently now, and that's maybe one of the reasons why it hasn't worked as well for him in recent years? Because you played in the Premier League when he won it with Chelsea there just a few years ago.
No, definitely. Look, it's like anything nowadays, you can't speak to players, certainly the younger generation. All the managers I played for, you'd get a telling off if you weren't playing well or whatever. That's gone though. You can't say nothing. And I suppose with Mourinho was that fear factor. He was the man in charge. As the lads touched on there, he had the ego. He was the center of attention at Chelsea, you know, all these big teams. He was the one, you know, even looking at him at Real Madrid, albeit it was like Messi v Ronaldo, but it was kind of Mourinho v Guardiola was on par. You know, and that was, he was center stage and he was the one. Nowadays, like you heard, or we probably all read, like he had a 4-hour rant at the players about, you know, what he thought about them, what, you know, had happened over the last 17 months. That's because he's leaving. You know, those days are gone now. You can't tell someone, you can't pull someone up in the changing room and let them know what you really think. You know, it gets leaked, it gets out, players just moan and groan. It's gone. And it is a shame because I love that. I love that beauty of the game. It's kind of, you know, that honest conversation where somebody tells you what they're really thinking. But unfortunately, nowadays, you can't do it anymore.
Do they need to sell Harry Kane and start again almost?
Well, you're the Spurs fan, JD, aren't you?
Need to sell the club. But who do you think they need?
The thing is, it's... We can sit here and talk about Harry Kane. It's just what is going on in between Harry Kane's head. Of course, look, they've got the cup final tomorrow. If they win that, is that enough for Harry Kane? Does he want to stay in, I think it's Jimmy Greaves' record, does he go and try and break that for Spurs, then the Premier League one? Or does he say, do you know what, I have enough. I've given everything to Spurs. I want to go to one of the Manchester clubs or whatever and try and win 3-4 Premier League titles. I believe he's 28 now. So like he's coming to the back end of his career. Now it's a serious question that he has to ask. So, you know, Daniel Levy is a businessman. He'll obviously set a price on Harry Kane. And it goes back then to what we were talking about earlier with Dan, like if Harry Kane does say that he wants to go, they're going to want probably 150 million for him. Then, you know, Manchester United fans will be calling out for their club to, you know, buy Harry Kane for 150 million. And you're wondering, well, where's the money coming from? Do they need to sell him? No. Like Spurs need to keep him and they need to reinvest, maybe clear out some of the other players and try and bolster the squad around him, tighten up the back four. I know Hugo Lloris gets a lot of stick. Still think he's a good keeper. He's not as bad as some people make out. But they need probably 2-3 defenders, tighten that ship up, probably a holding midfielder, and then the rest will take care of itself.
Which manager would you be looking to try and get if you were Daniel Levy there, David? Brendan Rodgers? He might not even want to go, I don't think, these days. They talk about maybe being Graham Potter or Steve Cooper.
I think you have to try and prize Brendan away. Brendan always speaks about projects, and obviously he's got something fantastic going on with Leicester. So you need to prize him away from that. The other one, I think, would be Julian Nagelsmann. He could be an interesting one. He's obviously an up-and-coming manager. He's got good experience in the Champions League, albeit he is taking on two giants in Dortmund and Munich. But, you know, why not? Like, you look at Graham Potter, it's kind of, yeah, he's tried to do something good at Brighton, but can he come into Tottenham and recreate that? Who knows? I think if they sign Graham Potter, if it wasn't going well after 12 months, they'd look to remove him. Whereas I think if they brought in a Nagelsmann, they'd give him more time.
Okay, we got to take a break. 53106, your text messages, folks. Off the Ball Saturday with David Myler, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward, speaking about the League of Ireland and Dublin's now. Well, we don't have the games, do we, for Euro 2020 anymore. We'll speak about the outcome of that after this break.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5, joined by the former Republic of Ireland international David Myler, football correspondent of the Irish Independent Dan McDonald, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward, to talk about the beautiful game, as well as listening on News Talk. You can watch us on the social channels for Off the Ball, for Periscope on Twitter at Off the Ball, YouTube, Facebook, and on the new OTB Sports app. Search OTB Sports in your app store to download it if you haven't already. And 53106 is the text number. Getting plenty of them in still on the Super League and other matches. I enjoyed watching Shamrock Rovers Bohemians last night, lads. It was one of these end-to-end games, which Rovers won by 2-1. I suppose, Dan, it was a controversial refereeing decision that clouded, I suppose, the discourse around it.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking there, how many times this season do we talk about Premier League games, and it's a VAR discussion. So, you know, at home here, we have no VAR. So always what you have is like the retrospective take on like what a football debate is like after a game. And this is the no VAR world, where we have a decision made in real time with no slow motion angles, with no slowed down view by Paul McLaughlin, the referee last night, which is a controversial decision that basically turns the game or decides the game, you know, where James Finnerty gives away a penalty for a foul on Danny Mandrew and get sent off as well. And unfortunately, by the letter of the law, the type of offence that was, I'm not sure if people would have seen it, but see, there was obviously changes a while back where like the double jeopardy rule, as it was discussed, or the triple punishment, where, you know, if you have a red card and a penalty, you know, is that out of the equation? But actually, the way the rules are phrased now is that if the referee decides that the deems that the player has made no attempt to play the ball and it's a professional foul, it's a red card as well as a penalty. And that's the type of foul that the Paul McLaughlin thought it was. Now, you watch the replays and you're thinking, I'm not so sure that's a penalty at all. But I can understand probably in real time why that decision was reached, because Mandrew had built up a bit of speed and, you know, Finnerty put up his arm. But it's really harsh. You know, it was still quite harsh, but... I think Johnny actually thinks it was a penalty, but we'll come to his take on it in a second. But I mean, overall, it was an enjoyable game. It was a bit like the first half of the Liverpool Newcastle game today, in a way. Like, sometimes these games behind closed doors are just very open in a way that I don't think they would be if there was, like, you know, a full house there, or if there was a crowd there. But it was just end to end and really loose and pretty entertaining, but sort of almost unusual in a way for a Rovers Bows game, which is normally pretty tightly contested. But actually, it was good quality in terms of, like, you know, attacking play, maybe a bit open defensively, but like the TV viewer doesn't really care too much about that. And, you know, some good young players involved in that game last night, who I think will have pretty decent careers as well.
Bohemians caused problems for Rome. I mean, Liam Burt missed a chance, Georgie Kelly missed a chance. It wasn't plain sailing for the champions all the time.
No, it wasn't. And I mean, I think there was even a bit of chat after the game. I wasn't there. I was watching it on TV, but there was a bit of chat after. Georgie Kelly had a great chance in the second half, hit the post. But there was a suggestion, you know, if he'd gone down for a penalty it might have been given, which didn't seem obvious to me at the time, but I think that might have been some of the chat afterwards. But no, like, I mean, Rovers are top of the table. They're defending champions. I was at their game up in Drogheda during the week. Like, they're not necessarily playing particularly well at the moment, but they keep winning, which is a pretty good habit. But, I mean, Bowes definitely, like, you know, they found some gaps. And, you know, there was a real spell after half-time where it was really unusual to see Rovers, like, you know, struggle for a spell as they did. But they still ended up with the 3 points at the end of it.
Do you prefer the old way, Johnny, that we have in the League of Ireland, that we don't have VAR?
I actually, for some reason, that came into my head during the week about, you know, if you had a poll with League of Ireland fans, not a hope they'd want VAR. And, you know, was it not a great talking point last night, that decision that was made? You know, maybe as I watch back replays, I might slightly address my own opinion on it. At the time, I thought Finnerty knew exactly what he was doing. I thought he cut Graham Burke off, made no attempt to get the ball. And by the letter of law, then he had to get a red card. But, you know, VAR, no, I couldn't have VAR in my mind. I think if you ask League of Ireland players, managers, fans, none of them would, like, very few of them would want VAR, would be totally voted out. But the game itself, I mean, if you look at the team Stephen Bradley picked, to have McCann playing, but then having Dylan Watts, Danny Mandroyu, and Graham Burke ahead of him, as well as Aaron Green. Like, so effectively almost three number 10s, and McCann, who's like an aging enough midfielder. What is he, 33 or so? And Bowes were able to find loads of gaps in that Rovers defence. I mean, they really should have gotten something out of the game. It was a brilliant, brilliant watch. I don't know if Stephen Bradley's team selection was, what would you call it, brave or aggressive? And they got the job done, but it was a very, very, it meant for a really interesting game. And as Dan kind of said there, with these young players now, I was at St. Patrick's during the week against Watford, and young Ben McCormack and Dara Burns for St. Patrick's, young Dubliners, they were fantastic. And then you have two kids for Sligo having a massive role in a brilliant game against Bohemians during the week. You have young Ballymun kid, Ross Tierney, last night playing for Bowes. And it was just, I actually think the League of Ireland's in a great place. Maybe in some respects on the pitch, if we talk about maybe Rory Higgins getting the Derry job, with Rory Higgins, Stephen O'Donnell, Stephen Bradley and Tim Clancy, four really talented young and innovative young managers in the league, as well as the very good tactical nous of, we'll say, Liam Buckley and Ollie Horgan and other managers like that. And it's just a shame there wasn't a crowd at a game like that last night, because it was fantastic football. And I'm not sure Shamrock Rovers, like, just watching them last night, there are definitely holes to be picked in them at the moment. They've kept on finding a way to win, but St. Pat's have made a good start. And as much as Stephen O'Donnell, he'd probably be playing it down. I think it won't be a formality this season, but I'm really enjoying the football. I'd just love to get crowds back so they can enjoy it too.
David, are you plugged into the League of Ireland, given I know you do a little bit of work with the underage team here, the 17s?
I prefer not to talk because sure. Cork City are struggling massively.
Yeah, it's actually grim where Cork are on the table. It's unbelievable, actually.
Dan, don't rub it in, though. Look, I'm not as invested as the lads are. I'm not going to pretend to be. I look for Cork City. I watch out for Cork City and Cove Ramblers. Obviously, I play for both teams. So I'm a Cork man at heart. I don't really care what Bowes, Rovers and those boys are doing. Not going to lie. But look, it's disappointing. Cork City, they've lost, what is it, the last four games. It's not great. But I have faith we can turn it round.
Yeah. Good start to the season for St. Pat's. What's the key to that, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Johnny's after claiming Dara Burns as a Dubliner. I'm pretty sure he's from Drogheda direction, but they do have some good young players and a good young manager, as Johnny mentioned. And I think like you know, Chris Forrester back as well, playing and enjoying his football. I mean, you know, he did a very interesting interview, Chris Forrester, during the week with Alan Cawley on his podcast, and you know, Chris was one of the probably, you know, players we were really excited about a couple of years back, you know, Irish players in England at Peterborough. And actually that interview was sort of remarkable in a way. He spoke about how he just, like, I've heard of homesickness and that being an issue for players, but really, like, you know, really nice fella, Chris, but just struggled with living away really badly. Wasn't prepared for living away from home. Real home bird, and probably something that, you know, he lost his confidence. He probably struggled a bit with his mental health, and like he has said all this himself, you know, he's very open about this, and probably someone really who ability wise, you know, shouldn't have been coming home, really. Like, you know, when he was doing well at Peterborough, like he was talked about, I think he was in one of those 40-man Ireland squads, but quite seriously there was interest at, you know, Championship and even maybe even Premier League level, and then he just lost his way at, you know, for a variety of reasons. So you've got someone like him back, and Stevie O'Donnell seems to have found the key to him. And then what you have is he's signed some players from Dundalk who were there during their very successful time. You know, Robbie Benson, John Mountney, you know, Paddy Barrett's come home from being away. So they have a bit of that dressing room culture that they had there. And as Johnny then does correctly mention, some of the young players that are coming through. So they've got a good blend. And they've got a chance of, I think, you know, having an OK season. But the big problem with the League of Ireland, like, you know, is still the sort of disparity sort of financially in terms of between squads and stuff. Pats still have a reasonably small squad, whereas, you know, Rovers have a pretty strong squad. I mean, Dundalk have a very strong squad as well, but they're, you know, they still haven't won a game yet. But like, I think Pats have a chance of making the season somewhat interesting if they keep it up. But yeah, it's a well-managed side with a good balance in their squad, which is a, you know, it's a big thing.
So Stephen Kenny losing Rory Higgins from his backroom staff is not a situation where we talk about it in terms of what happened with Damien Duff, what happened with Alan Kelly. It's just that Rory Higgins has got a great opportunity now at Derry City.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, I mean, I spoke to Rory Higgins yesterday for a piece in today's paper, and I think, like, he would have been very conscious. Like, he's very close to Stephen Kenny. Like, he's you know, Stephen Kenny, we played with Stephen Kenny at Derry. Kenny then brought him to Dundalk as a player and then as a coach, you know, and in sort of his entire coaching career, the only time he hasn't been working with Stephen Kenny is when Stephen went up to the 21s and didn't really probably have a full-time job to be offering. And the minute he became senior manager and took over from Mick, he brought Higgins with him. But yeah, like Rory's 36, he's ambitious. I think, as Johnny mentioned, there's probably a new breed of young managers there in the league now who probably see the doors that Stephen Kenny has opened and will naturally think themselves, well, if I make a name for myself at home here, who knows where it could take me? And that's a very noticeable thing about the league at the moment. There is some very well-regarded young managers there at the moment. And I think Rory Higgins is ambitious. He always fancied going into management. And while he has a good job at the moment, as, like, you know, or had a good job as a chief scout and opposition analyst, I know last weekend I spoke to him. He was over watching three games in League One. He, you know, was watching games everywhere. And, you know, a great job in many respects. But he's got the chance to go out on his own as a manager, to have his club 3.5-year contract, his local club, to start his managerial career, you know, to be given a real proper crack at it, a real proper go at it. The best thing I watched on TV this week was the documentary about Derry City. It was on BBC on Monday. I think I'd recommend anyone to seek it out on the BBC Player if they can.
Why?
Called Different League. It was about how Derry City, I mean, the anomaly that Derry City are obviously a club based in Northern Ireland. As much as you go to Derry, it's really, you know, it's sort of the wrong side of the border. But, you know, a club based in Northern Ireland that joined the league in the Republic in the 80s after, you know, years out of football because of the Troubles, and how Derry City came into the League of Ireland, you know, and how it was like a movement for the Derry people of Derry, for the, like, for the city of Derry, that all of a sudden they had a football club to represent them on a stage, so that Derry was making the news for reasons other than bad stuff. Like, an amazing thing. Like, I've always heard growing up about this, you know, that and I caught the tail end of it going to the League of Ireland games in the 90s, that Derry used to have big support. But when Derry came into the League of Ireland in the 80s, the fan base they had was incredible. They brought 19,000 people to a game in Cork for a cup quarter final down in Cork. Like, to think of that trip from Cork to Derry, like, it's the worst trip in football for you talk to players in the League of Ireland, you know, doing it in a day or whatever. So 19,000 fans travelled from Derry to Cork for a game, which is sort of mind-blowing, but showed, like, the potential. And, you know, it's obviously interwoven with, like, the, you know, the social history of the time of Derry. A great documentary archive footage of you know, Jim McLaughlin and John Hume and all the people. And, like, that you know, Derry really is like a sleeping giant in some respects. Like, you know, you see someone like James McLean and the passion he has for his hometown, and is, like, still has it for Derry City. And, like, I think that's why for someone like Rory Higgins, who's a local person, the chance to go and take over that club and try and tap into that and try and get it going again was too good to turn down, even if it meant leaving a good job. But he was at pains to stress, you know, he's left on great terms with Stephen Kenny. He's sad to leave Stephen Kenny, and it shouldn't be added to the list of, oh no, he's lost another staff member. Because I mean, the other ones that left, they weren't going to some other job or something. I mean, this is very clearly what's happened in the case of Higgins.
I think as well, JD, what's nice is that, you know, as Dan said there, Rory Higgins has spent a lot of the last several months and so on going around England watching, Premier League games to some extent, watching Championship games, and he's moved away from the League of Ireland in terms of watching the amount of League of Ireland games he would, but he still wanted to come back to the League of Ireland to kind of start what he would hope to be his coaching career, because he knows there's a lot of quality in the League of Ireland. He knows that he can probably make Derry City into a better team, but he knows that week to week he's going to be taking on very, very innovative young coaches as well that he would respect. And even though he's coming from the international setup, he went back to the League of Ireland because he's a huge affinity with Derry. But if the League of Ireland were crap, he wouldn't be doing this, because he knows that there is a huge potential in this country, and he knows now with younger players potentially staying here that we are at an exciting time if the government can get behind it. He knows that Derry City could be a much bigger force, and he knows that Derry City is a proper football town. And he will know week to week that he'll be strongly challenged as a manager, and there's no guarantee whatsoever it's going to work for Rory Higgins. As much as he's so much respect within the game, this is a tough, tough league. Managers can be on the scrap heap very quickly. You have to remember Stephen Bradley at Shamrock Rovers. People were amazed, even some of his players, I think, were amazed that he stayed in the job as long as he did, because they didn't start that well. He was given time. And along with Steve McPhail, I think Shamrock Rovers have become a really, really good football side. There are really good young coaches in this league. And, maybe some people were tuned into the game last night. If they didn't enjoy that game, they're probably watching the wrong sport, because there was so much quality in that game last night. The likes of Danny Mandroyu playing, obviously Chris Forrester at Pats. And then you have young players around the league with technical qualities. That the league is in a very good place on the pitch, to my mind. And I think Rory Higgins would definitely add to that. But he wouldn't be taking up that job unless he appreciates the quality in it.
Dan touched on something interesting there, homesickness, David Myler. Was that something you ever suffered from when you first went over to England, or how did you deal with it if you did?
I think I've mentioned it before, but like obviously when I signed for Sunderland, my father was with me, and then obviously we went back to the hotel. He was leaving first thing in the morning, left a note under my door and just kind of said, that's it. He said, there's no home for you anymore. There's nothing here for you. That was just kind of the way I dealt with it. I believe I went over at the start of June. I didn't return till Christmas. I think with anything, you have to buy into what you're going to do. That was it. It was all I ever dreamt of. It was all I ever spoke about. I wanted to play in the Premier League and to be given the opportunity. I couldn't be thinking of what my mates were doing at home or what was I missing out on. I never suffer from homesickness. I know lads have suffered from it, but look, you get an opportunity like that. I imagine if you ask any lad who's been over to England, who's come back to Ireland years later, would they have done certain things differently? I imagine they would have. But I never had it, never worried about it. Anytime like my family wanted to come over, they came. But even so, they didn't really come. My dad came to nearly every game, every reserve game I played. So I always kind of saw him. He went that extra mile of like traveling hours upon hours just to, for a Thursday night game, and we'd in a stadium to play against Everton or Liverpool or one of those. He was always there. But I just kind of got on with it. I was a young man whose mother and father did everything for him, whether it be cooking, cleaning, all that, ironing. And then when I went to England, I remember I got an apartment for myself, and my mum wrote me out a list of things to get. I needed to get like a microwave, an ironing board, a washing machine, all of it. And I had to learn as I went on. That was part and parcel of it. It was all I ever wanted, so I never really thought too much about it. Look at me now. I moved over at 19, 32 next month, and like I've no real plans to move home. Just how life goes.
Fair play, David. Fair play.
Just on that, JD, I know it's worked out for David, but like it shouldn't have been the case in this country that basically any player worth any sort of ability as a youngster had to go to England. It's very, very tough to go to a different country. As a young person, you may not have any friends around you. You may not have a family network around you. Maybe then a lot of players get injured or a manager leaves the club and things go wrong. And it's a tragedy, really, that so many of our players had to go to England because the league here was so poor and the footballing structure in this country was so bad, despite the fact that football has so much support in this country that basically every kid worth anything went to England to try it out. We just exported them across and left them to their own devices. Many came back on the scrap heap. Many would have come back pretty much with suicidal inclinations, not to mind like a loss of love for the game. And we have an opportunity now in this country because of Brexit to create a proper football industry, to help clubs, to educate kids and to keep them here. And politicians really do need to listen to that, because as Dan said about Chris Forrester, and he was doing well over in England, players that come back here, they're often in a very, very bad way because they've had to immigrate at a young age, and it's very tough. And I really hope that we've turned a corner in that regard, or certainly will in the next decade or so.
I think it's striking, like David, you didn't go over at 15 though as well, David. You were small but older when you went over, which is part of, like, you know, I think, listen, I'm a big League of Ireland fan and I want it to be as good, but as it can be. But look, we have to be realistic and know that players are still always going to leave Ireland, even if it's 18 now. But it's even just that little small, I'm guessing, and listen, I'm putting words in your mouth, you could tell me now, actually, I would have been fine if I was over 15, 16, and maybe you had the strength and the network that you would have been. But did going a small bit later benefit you? Like, maybe you don't know, because you didn't do the alternative.
No, you don't need to put words in my mouth, because you're spot on. Me and my dad have laughed about this 50 times. If I'd gone to 15, I'd have been home by 18, 100%. I was too immature. I didn't have the right kind of, I won't say with the right structure, but the kind of right mentality to go over at that age. Like, it is, I was very fortunate, because we always kind of compare to a ladder. If you go over at 15 or 16, you're trying to get into the 16s, and then you go into the 17s, you're trying to step up. And every year there's almost more time to fall, whereas I went straight over into the reserves. And it was kind of like, can I get into the reserve team? I got into the reserve team straight away. And then it's like, can I get training with the first team? Can I make a match day squad? You know, there was kind of less steps for me to progress, but also in the same time, there's less steps for me to mess up. Like, if you go at 16, there's other influences. You're kind of going into digs. You're at that age where you're not mature. You know, you're up to no good. You kind of think you can get away with everything. I do agree with you. If I'd gone at 15, 16, I definitely would have been home in 2 or 3 years. I believe there was an opportunity to go to Nottingham Forest, but my mother was totally against it. When I eventually went, I dropped out in January before my leaving cert. My mum wasn't happy. To this day, she's still not very happy. She still thinks I should have done my leaving cert. That's another conversation. But I definitely, it is very difficult that at that age, you know, you're only a teenager, whereas I was suddenly becoming a young adult, where you kind of like, now's the time, you have to grow up. This is what you want to do. You have to be ready for it and prepared for it. And at 16, you're probably in this bubble of, you go into digs, and it's kind of that family feeling, which is great, but it's almost everything is done for you. Whereas I had to go and learn how to do a lot of things on my own. Albeit my wife will probably disagree. I know how to cook. I don't like to cook at home. She does, to be fair to her, I have to give her credit. She takes care of everything. But I had to learn all those things. And I think even when you go at 16, you're kind of just solely focused on football. You kind of don't grow up. You know, I had to go find an apartment. I had to go find a car. I had to get myself sorted with all the stuff I mentioned. You kind of, you take on that responsibility where you don't have time to think about being homesick. You kind of just have to crack on with it all.
We got the teams from the West Ham Chelsea game. It's a 5:30 kickoff for the London Stadium, and Joe Rawson.
after a debacle of a week off the pitch. This is a crucial game for both on it in the race for Champions League qualification. Chelsea's draw in midweek against Brighton means they go into the game level on points with the Hammers. Thomas Tuchel makes six changes from that match, with Mendy, Thiago Silva, N'Golo Kante, Ben Chilwell, Timo Werner and captain Cesar Azpilicueta all coming into the 11. For West Ham, Craig Dawson is suspended. Fabian Balbuena comes into the team for him, and Ryan Fredericks replaces Ben Johnson, who drops to the bench. Big game at the London Stadium. It's West Ham versus Chelsea.
They're hanging in there doggedly, David Myler, West Ham. Can they finish top four, though, or do you see this Chelsea and Leicester?
Why not? You know, why not believe they can?
Yeah.
You know, it's been an incredible journey. Today is going to be the real test. If they could get a victory today, obviously they'd be very disappointed with the result against Newcastle. I think today will be the one. If they can win that game today, then you'd have to tip them to finish in top four, especially with Liverpool dropping points. Let's be optimistic. You know, it would be a fairy tale story of them getting in. It's going to be a tough game against Chelsea, of course. Great result against Manchester City, which will give them massive confidence. Obviously, they're going into the Champions League semi-final against Madrid as well, so they'll be looking to put in a performance. But it should be a fascinating game.
Do you give Spurs any chance tomorrow against City?
No. No, I'm only waiting you up, Jay, because I actually want Spurs to win because Ryan Mason's in charge.
You know Ryan.
I'd like this. Yeah, I play with Ryan. Obviously, he used to sit next to me in the change room. Obviously, I was got it from, I was the one who replaced him on the pitch when he took that, you know, that head injury. Still speak to him. Haven't spoken to him since, you know, he's taken off, because I imagine he's very busy. But it's obvious that he's doing a lot of impressive things at Spurs. Obviously, he's moved, you know, roles. He seems to be progressing the whole time. Look, I'm not saying he's going to be the one to take him forward come next season. I do think they need someone experienced, but it's certainly, you know, a learning curve for him. I know he wants to go down that route, you know, further on in his career. So I actually would love to see Spurs win tomorrow just for, you know, to see Raheem Mason lift the trophy.
How does that make you feel, David, when lads that are younger than you are now managing in the Premier League level as such? It's the next stage, of accepting, age for a lot of people. He's, 30, isn't he, or something? It's sort of
29. Yeah, he's 29. Yeah, it is. It's brilliant. Obviously, look, gutting what happened to Ryan. Obviously, his career being cut short. Ryan obviously made the decision a bit quicker than I did. Obviously, when I retired, he went into the media route. He was doing a lot of stuff with Sky and whatever, on the radio as well. He was doing his coaching. I'm a bit the same. I'm doing a bit of both. He committed to coaching because he didn't really fancy the media. I don't know what I want to do. Obviously, which I want to kind of commit to. I'm involved with the Ireland under-17s. I've nearly finished my A license. Will I go down that route? I don't know.
How much are you afraid of failure in that, David? How much are you afraid of it going wrong and you'd be deemed a managerial failure?
I'm very fortunate that my father is a manager. He's kind of regarded as, you know, at his time as Wexford, he could be regarded as a failure at Cork because he didn't win the All-Ireland. So I've plenty of experience to draw on there. Obviously, he won't be happy with me saying that, but it's nice to have someone who's been involved in management for the best part of, ever since I was born. I think he was in charge of Kerry in 94, 95. I'd have been 5 or 6.
They beat Waterford, didn't they? They beat Waterford in the Munster Championship.
Oh yeah, he had great success with Kerry. That was just another one of the ones he'd. Carlow, he's had. I think he's trying to do the full count, isn't he? But I'm not scared of failure. No, it's definitely something that I would like to pursue and just see what happens. Look, you can't. I don't think, Johnny, you can go into it thinking that you're going to fail or be scared of that. Albeit everybody wants to be successful, they want to do well. I'm not stupid enough to believe that it's going to be all roses in the garden. There will be testing times, but that definitely wouldn't bother me. I just definitely do think I need more experience to kind of get a know-how of everything first before I throw my name into some hat somewhere.
But isn't it interesting though that I think maybe 20 years ago, like the idea of a younger manager getting opportunities, it wasn't really a done thing. Maybe there's this Kenny Dalglish with player manager at Liverpool. There's always examples you can throw out. But, I mean, it does seem now a lot more acceptable to give younger managers their opportunity. It's almost like fashionable you know, to go that way. So is there a sense that you have to move at it quickly as well too? Listen, you retired earlier than you should have in a way, if you know what I mean. But that you can't wait for too long either, if you know what I mean. That you sort of have to get on the ladder as well quickly, because there's always another generation coming through as well after you.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's like, for example, I was doing commentary on Hull and Sunderland the other night, and Andrew Taylor, I'm not sure how familiar you are, played left back for like Wigan and Cardiff, whatever. And he was one of the coaches, and I was kind of like, how'd you get in there? A lot of the time it is who you know, and you can kind of get in the door and you kind of get yourself in around, and look, God forbid, results don't go well. And all of a sudden it's kind of like, well, we've got this young fella, you fancy it. And kind of like, that's where you have to grab the opportunity. If something does arise, like, am I ready? No, I'm not. I need more experience, like I said. But if something did come, you kind of have to learn on the job. You'll never know if you're ready till you find yourself in, you know, having to make those decisions. But definitely there is a lot more younger managers are given the opportunities. I don't know why that is, but it can only be a good thing. But at the same time, there is a lot of people looking for those jobs, isn't there?
Mm. Yeah, okay. David, Dan and Johnny, I hope it's sunny wherever you are in the Northeast, David, because it's absolutely glorious here. But enjoy the rest of the weekend, guys.
Thanks, cheers, Jimmy.
Thanks, lads.
OTB Football Saturday with David Myler, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward. Just some scores. Newcastle won earlier on. Joe Willock with a late equaliser for the Magpies. West Ham against Chelsea is a 5:30 kickoff. Sheffield United against Brighton at 8:00 this evening. The Championship, Bournemouth 0, Brentford 1 a full-time from earlier, and matches about to finish. Latest scores, Barnsley 1, Rotherham 0, Blackburn Rovers 5, Huddersfield 2, Cardiff City 2, Wickham 1, Coventry 0, Preston 1, Derby 1, Birmingham 2, Middlesbrough 3, Sheffield Wednesday 1, Nottingham Forest 1, Stoke 1, QPR 1, Norwich 3, and Watford 1, Millwall 0. Don't forget Off the Ball tomorrow, with Joe Molloy sitting in the chair from 1 until 7. We'll bring you live and exclusive commentary of the Premier League showdown between Leeds and Manchester United. Great rivals from Elland Road. Stephen Doyle and Brian Carroll call the shots for that one. We'll also have the Sunday paper review. Grainne, McIlwain and Kieran Cunningham picking out the best stories. Mayo Gaelic football legend Kevin McStay, handy soccer player in his time, will join us for a feature interview. We'll also get the reaction to Ireland's Women's Six Nations win over Italy with Alison Miller. So we'll be sure to tune in for a brilliant show tomorrow between 1 and 7 on News Talk. If you missed our Saturday panel review of the week, the Super League crisis and debacle and the fall of it, Dave McIntyre, Michael Verney and Timmy McCarthy spoke about that, and also about Ronan O'Gara and the World Snooker Championship and the Gaelic season returning. If you missed any of that or any of OTB Football Saturday with David Myler, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward, you can find the podcasts of our content on the OTB Sports app. Search OTB Sports in your app store to download the app for iOS and Android. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon. We'll speak soon. Bye-bye.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.